All right, hello. We're going through chapter 14 today of the Object Relational Material. Dr. Robert Kaper, Instinct, Fantasy, and Early Psychic Processes. All right, I got to talk for a few minutes about this idea of fantasy. This seems to be bedrock. It's come up before, it'll come up again in spades. So what is a fantasy? Let me turn right away Material by Susan Isaacs. All right, this is just a straight-up definition, but I want to read it because it's important. Bottom of page 160 of the readings. Fantasy is, in the first instance, the mental corollary, the psychic representative of instinct. There is no impulse, no instinctual urge, which is not experienced as unconscious fantasy. Moreover, the particular content of the urges or feelings, for example, wishes, fears, anxieties, triumphs, love, or sorrow, dominating the mind at the moment, is also represented by a fantasy. In speaking of instinctual urges, one is speaking, as far as the mind is concerned, of unconscious fantasy. The same is true of emotions. What we call emotional states are, at bottom, unconscious fantasies. This is a revolutionary way of thinking. And it's necessary for you to wrap your minds a little bit about what this idea of fantasy is all about. Now, you've all had fantasies. We all wonder what I'd do if I won the lottery. We all wonder what life would be like if we were dramatically different than we are. Daydreams are fantasies. Everybody's got them. That's not what we're talking about. This is unconscious, but it has similar attributes. They are describing not the id, the ego, and the superego. They're describing the same function, but not in terms of classical psychic structure, not in terms of a building superstructure, the girders that build it up. Freud uses the phrase structure, psychic structure, id, ego, and superego. That's the psychic structural model. Klein and her followers use this idea of fantasy and shifted the way we think about human mental functioning. And they shifted it in a way, number one, that seems a lot more complicated, but two, also a lot more realistic or useful, or a way that seems to reflect how we actually experience things in the world. You've all had dreams, right? And you wake up in the morning, especially if you've had a real powerful one, you wake up in the morning and there are moments when those fantasies, those dreams, are so powerful and so real, it's hard for you to tell which part of you was waking up and which part of you was sleeping. They're so powerful, they seem, don't they? So incredibly real. When you're in the middle of a dream, even if it's bizarre, you're going, oh, look, giant monster. I'm scared. But there's no question of, wow, I'm really glad this is a dream because this ain't even close to real. It's never like that. The dreams feel so powerfully real. And I think what Isaacs and Betty Joseph and the rest of Klein's students went on to suggest, what Klein herself suggested, was that that's in fact how the mind is structured. It isn't some superego, whatever that is. You'll notice I've thrown that word out before. Well, it's the superego, as if that explains anything. Oh, well, if it's the superego, then that makes sense. No, it doesn't. It begs the question. It's sort of circular. What is the superego actually made of? How does it function? And the answer that the Kleinians had was, the superego is, in fact, a fantasy. Introjected, taken in Freud's words, identified the father or mother or the powerful figures in the child's life who he or she identifies with are taken in. And when you feel guilty about stealing the cookie when you're little, it's not that your superego is being punitive, it's that you have a fantasy of a harsh father, a judgmental mother, criticizing you, threatening you. Your fear is of abandonment. The fantasy, the guilt feelings, is fears of abandonment, of persecution. But that makes so much more sense than some structural model with a thing called a superego. My sense is that the Kleinian way of thinking is more what we call experience near. It reflects a sensibility that in clinical experience, and I think just walking around, makes more sense. Your dreams are vivid, seemingly real in the moment. That's exactly what they're describing as the building blocks of your minds, of your personality, of your character. You are the sum total of your accumulated, identified with objects, introjected, I don't care what the word is. You take them in somehow, and they populate a mind, and their relationships within you and their style of relating represents the core elements of your personality. Are you a loving, nice, healthy, appropriate person who can be in relationships with other people in ways that are useful and healthy? Klein would suggest that you have taken in enough love, that your object relationships are steeped in good objects. You trust the good objects. You have faith that the good things will happen because you've taken in all this good experience. But if you're a little paranoid, if you're a little cynical, if you're not a particularly nice person, if you're looking for the bad in others, they just suggest that you've taken in too much bad, that your fantasies are too drenched with the hostility that wasn't worked through into a more mature position where love mitigates hate. I love that phrase. Love, the mitigation of hate by love. The net effect of your childhood, the question that the Kleinians would ask are, have you had enough love to contain, to build up within yourself a good enough set of objects to overcome, to control, to contain the inevitable badness that you also experience? What child grows up without fear? What child grows up without loss or pain or frustration or anger or rage? All the primary emotions that we all have, and what Klein suggested, we all had from a very early age. If, on the whole, we manage to acquire enough good object functioning, then the stuff that's bad can be dealt with. It's always there. Sometimes it breaks out. Everybody has a bad day. It gets a little snappy. Right? That's that bad object coming out again, uncontained a little bit, and then we pull it back, and the good objects take over again. It's complicated because it feels nebulous, and we're scientists. We like solid things. We like structure. We want to talk about id, ego, and superego. Okay? But think about it for a minute also from the id's perspective. What is the id? Sex and aggression. What are the fantasies? If the superego, the conscience, is a fantasy of the stern mother and father, or maybe even the supportive mother and father pushing you to do the right thing and threatening some guilt if you don't comply, the id is really a fantasy of what? Of aggression, of sexuality. When you think about sex, you don't have an academic text in your mind. You have fantasies. I think in the field of sex and aggression, it's more vivid. It's more obvious that Klein was onto something here in their use of language. Guys, when you're really pissed off, someone's done something bad, and you're about to throw down, and you're thinking about it, are you thinking about the cost-benefit analysis? Or are you imagining tearing this guy apart? Okay, in front of your girlfriend, who he's insulted. It's that fantasy that's so powerful, and Klein, I think, saw that in the minds of her very young children. Have you ever watched a two-year-old play? Have you ever watched a three-year-old play? Oh my God, they can be mean. They can be harsh. One doll is knocking the snot out of the other doll. And the horse is being thrown into the pit. And it's amazing how powerful they are. And they also have love together and they're all good friends. But you also see this other part. And I think Klein saw in children the more honest fantasy application, realization of the child's unconscious. Adults, we've learned to hide it better. But I think it's obviously there in a very powerful way. So this is Klein's idea, advanced from Freud, that our inner world, our psychic reality, is all about the object relationships, the internalized objects, the good one, the bad one, and all of the variations. She still talks about the ego, that sense of self that's sort of the center of all of this. But it seems to me that it's very useful, clinically, and very useful to think about my own relations to use this method. Okay. What we call emotional states are at bottom unconscious fantasies. I challenge you to think back in the loving fantasies you've had and in the aggressive and hostile ones, even the overt ones, even the conscious ones. You're not thinking in language, you're thinking in pictures. You're thinking in fantasies. And I think Klein saw that and simply moved that down where she thought it was primary. Where these fantasies really come from? The unconscious psychic reality. Okay. Continuum between unconscious fantasies. That's the point here, that there seems to be this continuum. That if we have these things in our waking life, she's trying to explain where they come from. And the tricky part for adults is that these primitive fantasies are experienced as concrete bodily feelings. And we've done this a million times. Everybody in this room has done this a million times. You have a feeling, and it's just the way things are. You're mad, therefore this person's done something bad to you, and you hate them for it. And how many times have you reacted from that place of emotion and realized the next day you overreacted? It may be explainable by thinking about how intense these unconscious fantasies are, how powerful they are, and how likely we are, without some careful thought and some honesty, to simply assume that feelings are facts and we act on them. And very often they're not, and it results in our making decisions and doing things in reality that really are bad, destructive, at least maladaptive. Okay, that's the downside. The upside. What gives meaning in your life? A theory? I don't think so. I think these fantasies, one of their main functions is they attach a profound level of meaning to the relationships and to the things in your life. When you see something that represents a memory, when you hear a song, come on, we've all done this. You're a song. I heard the song Never Been to Spain by Three Dog Night. And most of you are younger than, no one ever heard of this group. But that was in, I think it was about 1972 or 3. And it was the last song I slow danced with my girlfriend before she dumped me. 20 years later, I couldn't hear that song without choking up. Was I doing a cost-benefit analysis of my relationship with her? Or was I transported to this moment of intimacy and love and care that turned out bad? It was a fantasy that gave those experiences profound personal meaning to me, gave that song meaning. I challenge you to imagine those similar things, which I know you've all done, to imagine yourself in those experiences. What's in your mind? Step back and watch your mind work. You're going to experience more often than not, I believe, something consistent with this way of thinking, fantasies, not just language or text or theory. Okay. Last little bit of complexity, not the last. Klein and Freud used introjection and projection. We take stuff in, we try to get rid of stuff as well. Klein talked about this as the sort of building blocks of mental structure, the building blocks of these fantasies. We take things in, they get processed through our own biological, genetic, instinctual component, our experiences together with our biological predispositions, and that melding, again, that's what she calls psychic reality. And you see already that it's not honest, it's not objective, it's not scientific. We do not respond to anything in our lives in some neutral way. Everything and everyone in our lives evokes something in us. Our perceptions are not pure. We look at the world through rose-colored glasses or darker ones sometimes, depending on what we bring to the relationship. So that's the conclusion, and the saying is, feelings aren't facts. And if you can keep that in mind and kind of ask yourself that question, what am I feeling? Why this? Why now? What am I bringing to the table that makes me feel that way? As opposed to, I feel this way, you must be doing something bad to me. Or the other way around. I love you. You must be perfect. How's that worked out for most of you? It works both ways. And that's sort of the beauty of the Kleinian model, is that the fantasies make up all the elements of our mind, the good, the bad, the regular. And I think what she's trying to say, although she, to the day she died, Klein maintained that she was the truest student of Freud, never wavered in that at all, thought she was merely continuing the work the way he might himself have continued the work had he lived a much longer time. So she's suggesting that the ego, the superego, the id, are what they are. But she's just decided to call them fantasies now, instead of the more mechanical idea of structure. But she maintained that the function of them was the same. Okay, if a little expanded. Okay. So, states of mind, all of your states of mind, the joyous ones, the afraid ones, the happy ones, the loving ones, the hating ones, are the sum total of your fantasized objects in relationship to each other. Now, if you think about that, what that tells you is that the child's mind is amazingly more complex than we ever gave it credit for in the past. We thought little children, little babies, are just bundles of joy, right? With occasional little bit of diaper rash. But it turns out that Klein suggested that if this is true for adults, that it has to start in childhood. And so the child's mind, which she saw in her play with the children, was infinitely more complex than we'd ever give them credit for. And I think that to me is one of Klein's biggest innovations, that we have to recognize that children are complicated, and part of our tendency to see them as simple represents our own needs, not the reality. Our feelings about babies don't often represent how babies are actually experiencing things. And if we don't know how they're really experiencing things, we can't meet their needs. If I'm not ready to acknowledge that much in a baby's mind is, as Klein said, tremendously painful, that they suffer greatly in these fantasies of persecution, in these fears that have no ability to contain themselves hardly at all, unless I'm able to take that in as a real possibility, why would I bother trying to soothe a distressed child? I might just say, oh, come on, it's no big thing, get over it. But if I do that, then I just condemn the child to suffer alone without help. And that's a disaster for the child. And it doesn't do much good for the adult either. So I think Klein, maybe more than anybody else, opened up the possibility for better child-rearing practices. I mean, that may be the big take-home lesson in Klein. The ability to look at what's really happening and deal with the psychic reality of a child's mind in a way that's nurturing and growing and containing and developmentally appropriate. If she'd done nothing else, that would solidify her place in psychology. Okay. All right, let's move to chapter 15, projective identification and the formation of the inner world. One of the shifts that Freud talked about, and we've talked about this early on, is this what seemed like a bit of a linear development. There's the oral stage, the anal stage, the phallic stage, Oedipus complex, latency, adolescence, and adulthood. And if you were mentally ill, you regressed back to an early level of development where you were fixated on some developmental problem that got you stuck. Klein didn't think this way. I've talked about this already. It's worth mentioning again. Klein talked about this accumulation theory, that the idea that we brought all these experiences with us and they were all with us at the same time. We don't regress in a linear way. If I'm going to get crazy, I don't have to go very far because I brought crazy with me, is the line I used before. And that feels right to me. Haven't you ever lost your temper? Haven't you ever blew up, had a meltdown, fell apart? In our language, we use phrases that seem to describe perfectly exactly what Klein is talking about as we access more primitive elements of our present mind. So one of the key shifts in her thinking between childhood and a more adult functioning, between the terror of the splitting and projection of primitive part-object relationships. The baby doesn't have a relationship with its mother. It has a relationship with a breast, because that's all it knows. It doesn't know Susie, the mother, who's 35 years old, married to Bob. Okay, that's not how the baby thinks of the mother. It can't. They don't have the mind for it. So their frustrations aren't mediated by reality. Their frustrations are global, as are their loves and commitments and devotions. So the anxiety at a baby's level is catastrophic. It's persecutory. It's paranoid. It feels psychotic almost in its intensity, in its reality-destroying intensity. And it's only when the child gets mature enough, through enough introjection, taking in of good objects, that the realization happens that the mother is not either good or bad. Bring the good mother back, make the bad breast go away. No, wait a minute, it's all good. It's mom who has some bad points to her that I have to now recognize. But the child's anxiety shifts. The child's anxiety shifts from this annihilation anxiety, this the world is going to be destroyed. I can't even say world because I don't know what a world is. I'm going to be burned up with this diaper rash. I don't know what diaper rash is. I'm just in pain. And it's the breast's fault. Make the bad breast go away. Make the good breast come back and fix me. I'm suffering. But then, and I hate the bad breast. Love the good breast. Hate the bad breast. Doesn't this sound ridiculous to talk like this? Wait a minute. Guys talk like this all the time. There's a little check for you. How many times have you heard some guy saying, I'm a this man or I'm a that man? That's so primitive. I mean, that our language reflects very often very primitive functioning, which can be understood using this way of thinking a lot. Some of it's beyond us, but some of it's available now. Okay, so when the infant realizes its mother is both good and bad, then the anxiety shifts from annihilation and persecution to guilt, regret, remorse. Oh my God, what I was thinking about, the bad mother, annihilation. And now I realize the good mother is they're the same, and I had these fantasies of annihilating mother, now I feel bad. Haven't you seen? I know you've seen this. Three-year-old gets angry in the cereal aisle of the grocery store. Wants the Cocoa Puff thingies. Mom says no. I hate you, kick. All right? And then what happens? Okay, sometimes there's a meltdown, and sometimes the kid keeps screaming, but often the kid sort of, I'm sorry, I love you. And you can see that incredible split and that incredible shift in the child's demeanor. They went from the all bad mother to the, oh my gosh, I've just kicked mom, and she's really not all bad, and I feel bad, and I gotta repair in the Kleinian sense. You can see it in their faces. They go from rage to love, and they're trying to process and handle this shift from the old anxieties, which are very intense, to the new ones, which are more adult, which are relating to a whole object, not a part object. And they're relating in a way at levels of anxiety that are much more manageable. Klein's idea of, quote, the immeasurable degree of suffering to be found in infants. First time I read that, I didn't like it. Not my children. They can't be subject to an immeasurable degree of suffering. That's horrible to think about. I feel guilty enough. So, but I think that required me to sort of step back, take a breath, and go, okay, what's really going on here? I know I don't like it, but just because I don't like it doesn't mean it's real, doesn't mean it's necessary to understand. Okay. So in this chapter, Dr. K brings up, Klein's idea of fairy tales. And I've already talked to you about them last time, but just to recap, this is another one of those little hints in our adult lives that suggests an explanation consistent with Klein's understanding of mental development. You've all seen, what, Transformers? You've all seen Superman? You've all seen these comic book characters come to life on the big screen. Excuse me. So what's going on there? It's always the same, isn't it? There's a good guy and a bad guy, and the bad guy wins and a good guy loses. Or the good guy wins and a bad guy loses. A little Freudian slip there, sorry. All right? But I think that's just a projection of our own sense of self. We recognize, we want to identify with a good guy, but we also find the bad guys a little bit fascinating. I think I told you the story of when my now eight-year-old stepson, the first time he saw Star Wars, he wanted to be Darth Vader. I think he identified rightly with the part of him that could be bad, but also was powerful and therefore kind of attractive, kind of seductive. And he would go around the house with his funny breathing and his lightsaber. I got him a lightsaber. Let him go with the fantasy for a while. He'll figure it out. But I think our movies and some of our stories reflect a psychic structure, a psychic reality that is explainable in Kleinian terms. Splitting, projection, seeing things in black and white terms. Come on, folks, what's politics? When was the last time a Republican thought the Democrats were reasonable people? When was the last time the Democrats thought the Republicans were thoughtful, moral human beings who had their legitimate perspective? I mean, if ever there was a place where Kleinian theory on human mental functioning is proven, it's in politics. Split, project, put all the bad things on the other side. What is genocide? What happened in Rwanda, in Cambodia? Right? What happened in downtown Seattle 5 years ago during Fat Tuesday when there's little mini riots broke out? We regressed to a splitting, a primitive mental function. I'm the good guys. They contain all the badness. But all that means is they take the badness inside of them and shoot it out there. What's homophobia? Heterosexuals that hate gays. But isn't it true that most of them really hate something gay about themselves, and they project it out, and then they hate something about themselves more than the people they're talking about? Homophobia, racism, always says more about the homophobe and the racist than it does about their target. It hits too close to home. They can't stand it, project it out, and there's no rational discussion. Are you going to send someone who commits a hate crime to a re-education camp where they'll learn how to be nice and polite to others? If Klein is correct, then those efforts are worse than useless. They're silly and probably counterproductive directly. If you see where hate comes from, if you see that we all are subject to these feelings, but most of us have managed to introject, take in, identify with enough good objects that our hate is contained, and we make reparation to those we love when we make a mistake, as we always do. So again, Klein, in terms of her developmental sequence, talked about the paranoid-schizoid position, and she talked about the depressive position. I apologize, the language is terrible, but the paranoid-schizoid position, using language that we usually associate with mental illness, is what Klein used to describe a developmental position. Primitive, birth to 6, 8, 9, 10 months, dominated by splitting and projection, dominated by extreme anxiety. And it's only later, the depressive position, where integration happens, where a child's mind becomes more adult and whole and responsible and able to take back the projections and heal the splits and see the people in their lives as whole objects instead of part objects, which could contain all of their bad emotions. Okay. The best example of this I've heard is a client of mine who I'd seen for several years, twice a week, so we had done a lot of work together. He came in one day and described the day before, and it was very boring, frankly. He was just, I went to work, I turned on my computer, I did this, I checked these emails, and he's walking me through this, and I'm bored, and all of a sudden I start feeling very sad. I start feeling just, I almost teared up. And my first response was to sit there quietly and examine what's going on. And my first thought was, did he say something that evoked something in me? No. Did I miss something? Boring. No. I had no doubt. I didn't know what to do. So I just sat there and kind of contained my feeling. I didn't do anything. I didn't say anything because I didn't know what to do or say. So I waited. About 30 seconds later, he says, oh yeah, one other thing. Last night, my daughter came home, young daughter, 16, fell in love a few weeks before, and she got her heart broken. The guy dumped her cold. It was bad. And I understood what happened almost immediately. He told me that like he was tossing off the other boring things of his day. And I realized very quickly that before he'd said that, I was picking up his projections. He's a father. He loved his daughters very much. And his daughters were in agony, their first broken heart. And he couldn't do a damn thing about it. And he couldn't feel. He couldn't feel that. It was too terrible for him. He didn't have the strength to see the reality, so he stuffed it. But he projected it out. It was bad. It hurt him. So he projected it out onto me. I took it in and went, oh, that hurts. And then when he relayed the story, I got it. His unconscious mind was talking to me, my unconscious mind, before his verbal communication was going on. Fortunately, I was able to figure out what was going on, and before he could go farther with his boring story of his day before, I said, wait a minute. And I said to him something like, that must have torn your heart out. That must have been so horrible for you to hear. And he just cried. With that interpretation, I brought to consciousness his unconscious feeling that he'd stuffed. I brought it back, and he felt the emotion then. But I would not have been able to help him had I not been able to sort of see that the idea of projective identification. Oh, I get what's going on. And I let him know that I understood and that he was understood at a level even he didn't understand at the time. Here's the good news. Here's the cool part. He went home that night, I found out later, and talked to his daughter again, because what had happened the night before? He goes in to see her, she's all crying, and his reaction was cold. He didn't feel anything, he couldn't. And his reaction was, don't worry, darling, there's lots of fish in the sea, you'll get over this, everybody goes through this. How helpful was that? Ladies, your heart ever been broken when you were a teenager? Did your dad come in and just say, don't worry, a lot of fish in the sea? How helpful was that? Not at all. It made it worse, because now you're really alone. Now no one understands your pain. And he goes back the next day and says, daughter, I made a mistake. I didn't understand quite what was happening yesterday. I do now. And I bet that hurt more than you've ever been hurt before. And I want you to know that I think I understand what you're going through. I'm very sorry. And she cried. But wow, pain shared is pain reduced. Pain understood by another is pain made tolerable. Okay? Pain you can survive. Pain you can grieve and get over and move through. But pain in abandoned is almost intolerable. And what was really cool is on Sunday, he's relating the story later, they had a few more words and it was all quite nice and reparative. And a couple days later, he's watching TV at night, Sunday night, he said, and she comes down, sits next to him on the couch and puts her head on his shoulder. Didn't say anything, just kind of sat there for a few minutes. And I thought, what an intimate moment. This was her, I don't know if she was conscious of any of this, but this is her telling him, thanks, Dad, I needed it, and you were there for me. And, I mean, I'm almost tearing up just telling the story. It was so powerful. But I could not have helped him had I not understood projective identification in exactly this way. All right. Chapter 16, the transformation of the superego, psychological integration, and growth. Okay, so this is where Klein goes back and walks us through her understanding of development. We are a long way from Freud's linear oral anal phallic stages. And again, I think it's appropriate to talk for a moment about this accumulation theory. We are stronger, healthier adults, as adults who've had adequate nurturing and development. But I think it makes sense to most of you to recognize that on a bad day, we can fall apart. I had a client come up last week, and she had a court case to go through. It was a no-contact hearing. Her husband, he was a classic perpetrator of domestic violence, slapped her around a lot, abused her rather badly. She finally found the courage to go to court and have a no-contact order. And the question was going to be for her, can I survive this? Or do I take my daughter and my passport and go back to Africa? Okay. I know a little about Africa. That didn't seem like a very good idea. Seattle's probably better than most places in the Sudan. Pretty sure about that. So, but the fantasy in her mind that she had accumulated through a lot of experiences was so powerful that the thought of going to court, where most of you recognize that judges try to do the right thing, that most victims of abuse do get some protection, the system isn't completely messed up. But she had this fantasy of walking into the lion's den almost literally. And it was my job to help her contain this anxiety. And just barely she did. She got to tell the judge exactly what had happened repeatedly, and the no-contact order was imposed for a year. And she called me back and said, I feel so much better now. But I don't think I could have helped her unless I'd been able to understand that developmentally, the experiences that she had as a child, as a teenager, in very difficult parts of Africa to be, were actually very much alive right here, right now, and she was in fantasy re-experiencing them in the transference. And I had to be able to name that anxiety and help her think about reality, separate her feelings from facts. What did she have to do to go through this court case and come out the other side protected? She could not allow herself to fall apart and give up and run away. That would have been a disaster for everybody, especially the child, I think, under the circumstances. So I challenge you, when you're feeling intense and emotional, to recognize that you've gone through a developmental process, you've accumulated good experiences and some bad ones and a bunch in between, and that your feeling states are always going to represent some constellation of fantasies that never 100%, and sometimes not very much at all, correspond to the reality that you're in. And I know no better way than that realization to make better decisions in the real world. If you can do that, if you can stop and wait and think and take a breath and have, you know, Donovan Bigelow sitting on your shoulder whispering loudly, is this a feeling or a fact? Is this just the way things are? Or are you bringing something to the table? I had a woman in class this morning, divorced, and her son, now 12, and the father are angry at her because she's dating after 5 years, okay? Waited 5 years to date, focused on the welfare of the son, good for her. And now she's pissed off at the son because, what am I supposed to do? I'm not supposed to date ever? And I said, no, you're supposed to realize that his fantasy, that in his fantasy life, you're abandoning him again. It's not his fault that he's angry with you. It's important that you recognize that this is a dynamic that he comes to honestly, that he's had an experience of abandonment. And he's mad at you because he's feeling that again. Are you abandoning him? No, but his psychic reality is screaming, not again, not again. And if you recognize that, and if you can say that, if you can interpret that, if you can acknowledge the reality of his psychic pain and fear, and not just say, dude, you're 12, get over it. You can't be this mad at me. I'm a good mother and I've tried really hard and I get to date. Deal with it. What do you do when you say that? You're just like my client who was telling his daughter there's a lot of fish in the sea. It's not helpful. That's the take-home lesson, I think, in the developmental stuff that Klein is talking about. Okay. Note. When Klein talks about a child splitting and projecting, and when she talks about that being in the paranoid schizoid position, it is very important that you recognize that she wasn't saying that children are insane, or children are psychotic, or children are paranoid, or schizophrenic, or anything like that. That she's simply describing a mental function, a primitive one, that if she was seeing it in adult, probably would be psychotic, described as psychotic. But in children, it's the appropriate developmental stage. It's all they can do. And I think the student's son is in the same position. It's all he can do. It's the sum total of his accumulated experience. His mother is leaving, and he's feeling drenched with anxiety and anger at being abandoned. So I want to be careful not to pathologize what are normal emotional responses to inevitable difficulty. Not every pain is pathology. Not every hatred is mental illness. We love and we hate and a lot of those emotions in between in the normal course of our human existence. So we have to ask, is it normal and developmentally appropriate at that time and place in that age group? And if it is, okay, then we manage it. If it isn't, then we have to intervene a little more aggressively. But you got to ask that question first. You can't assume that it's bad or it's mentally ill. Okay. And again, to summarize Klein's depressive position, we move out of splitting into a whole object relationship. We move out of part objects into seeing the others as whole. We shift out of paranoid anxiety into the normal guilt and grieving. We negotiate a path between love and hate. I think maybe the most important part of chapter 16 is the last two pages. Reparation, creativity, and normal psychological development. I ask you to read those very carefully. Here's the take-home lesson. He's saying, and Klein is saying, that it isn't an option to be creative or not. It isn't an option to have a life where you don't engage in creative work. You have to do something. You have to write. You have to work. You have to engage in some creative activity. You have to raise healthy children. You have to overcome some of your difficulties. The list is very, very broad. But what they're saying is that we are creatures who have evolved over a million years in a hostile, difficult environment. That's what we're tuned for. That's what we're geared for. Why did Rome fall? 472 AD, give or take change. The Romans had conquered everything. They were amassing tremendous wealth. They had the whole world that was known at their feet. There was no one left to conquer. What happened then? They started just taking money, extracting payment from the tribes. And what did they teach their sons in the next generation? Did they teach them conquest? Did they teach them war and nobility and courage in battle and all of the martial skills necessary to found an empire? No. And then what happened to their children? In three or four generations, the pride of the Roman legions were reduced to decadence and circuses and the terrible atrocities that were perpetrated when they started getting soft. And very soon the barbarians just came in and took over. They didn't conquer Rome. It rotted from the inside and fell apart. We're not creatures, Klein suggests, designed for the easy life. And you all know someone who's what they call a trust fund baby, right? You've all heard that phrase. Someone who whose parents are wealthy and they give them a trust. They turn 18, they turn 21, they turn 25, and they get $1 million. What happens to them most of the time? Badness. Nothing but badness. Okay? They become weak and decadent like the Romans, like maybe a lot of us in our rich society. We may be becoming this way. Klein's discussion here is a warning to us that we're not designed for the easy life. We're not designed not to face challenges, to overcome ourselves, to overcome obstacles in the real world. And she's challenging you to find that work that provides you with a healthy sense of being in the world, a healthy meaning, a healthy purpose. And then, again, the possibilities are very broad. Whatever floats your boat, if it's meaningful, if it's endlessly playing computer games, something's wrong. If it's learning how to use computer games and then figuring out how to design them and to make them better, then that's a different situation. Again, two people doing the same thing, one might be healthy and the other might be quite mentally ill. What's the meaning of the thing? So I think that those two pages that challenge, I mean, it's almost philosophical at that point. The idea that we are creatures who must be challenged. And that even child-rearing practices have to bring to the children challenges for them to overcome. How much effort do we spend making our child's lives as painless and anxiety-free as possible? There's a group in Seattle. They're called the Attachment Parenting Groups. They use the word attachment because that's a recognized, legitimate psychological field of study, attachment theory. And they've appropriated it, and they claim legitimacy. But they're a bunch of the sickest people I've ever heard of. They think in this delusional fantasy the child should never have any stress. And of course, one of the ramifications of that is you shouldn't potty train them because that causes them so much stress. If you just let them go, they'll figure it out. So in their homes, they don't potty train the kids. They walk around behind them with Clorox bottles and rags and clean up their messes. They give them no boundaries. They give them no structure. This says something about their own neurotic, projective processes None of this is within the needs of the children. It actually makes the children quite dysfunctional. I think exactly the way Klein's talking about in the last two pages of that chapter. That our children need structure. Our children need challenges to overcome. Our children need love and care. But be careful that maybe you're not projecting your own needs onto them while you make their life easier. How many ladies, how many guys have you known who hold themselves out a little bit like white knights, that they're going to rescue you? How many women hold themselves out as sort of damsels in distress to be rescued? My sense is for the guys in that mix, they themselves need to be rescued, have always needed to be rescued. And in the rescuing of another, they feel themselves healed. This, ultimately, how does that work out? Disastrously for both parties most of the time. So children need, and is it a balance? Of course it's a balance. We're not going to resort to Sparta. Anybody see the movie 300? Okay, we're not taking the children away at age 7 into militaristic camps where they're whacked around a lot. Okay, we're not going down that road. And yet, it seems to me that the attachment parenting people have gone the other way and maybe do as much damage. So that's the balance that you're going to have to strike with your own children, in your own lives, in your own relationships. How much of my feeling state represents a fantasy of not enough good objects being introjected or identified with? How much of what I'm doing is based on this transference or projection of my fantasies, and how much of it is really reality? Those are the questions that I think Klein has struggled with, and we've struggled in her absence for 50 years. So I'm going to call it now, and we're going to try to do summarize chapter 17, the early stages of the Oedipus complex, and Klein's more expanded view on that next time. So we'll call it now and take your questions in a few minutes. Thank you very much.